Good morning.
The good news is everything seems to be working today. So, last lecture was not performed live because of technical difficulties in the room, but I have recorded the lecture via Camtasia, and that's posted on Moodle. The topics covered last lecture was sort of a basic overview of digital communication systems, and we said that our goal was to get some message from sender to receiver, and potentially that message might be an analog message, a voice signal, for instance, or it could be digital data. Ultimately, everything that we transmit is in a digital form, so our goal is to eventually send bits. Okay. And so we saw that we had a sequence of steps that we needed to go through. If you started with this analog signal, then it had to be digitized, specifically what we discussed was sampling this signal. And then potentially that or a already digital signal would be processed for transmission. And we had, a number of steps it would go through. Source encoding is the process of trying to compress the signal, reduce the number of bits that you have to transmit. And this can be done in a lossless or a lossy fashion. And what we looked at specifically were source encoding techniques for voice signals. And so if you combine that with the A to D conversion, we said our sort of baseline is a pulse code modulation where you sample 8,000 samples per second and you encode those samples using 8 bits each, which gives you your 64 kilobit per second signal. And then we looked at various compression techniques, typically lossy techniques, so we'll not recreate the signal in its original form entirely, but could get significant reductions on the bit rate at which the signal had to be sent. And so we noted that particularly for wireless systems where bandwidth is at a premium, this was considered important. We didn't say a lot of channel encoding is sort of going the other way. You add redundancy, additional bits to help you deal with errors that occur in transmission. So if you transmit the bits over any channel, some of them are going to arrive and be decoded incorrectly. And so we wish to add some sort of redundancy to handle those errors as they occur, to either detect them or correct them. And we'll touch on it briefly again in terms of how this works or what common techniques are used for cellular systems, but for now we said this is something you probably would have seen in a basic networks course or Chapter 8 of Stallings. And then we looked at basic modulation techniques, and again we noted for a radio system the modulation was going to be sinusoidal in nature, and so you had to vary some component of the sinusoid, the amplitude, the phase, or the frequency. And for this sort of a system, and sort of specifically concentrating on modulation, we looked at the trade-off between the bit energy to noise ratio or the signal to noise ratio, the error rate you could get, and the bandwidth efficiency. So how, what sort of a bit rate could you achieve within a specific bandwidth? So what we're going to concentrate on today is the characteristics of the radio channel, and we will sort of note how these characteristics, or what these characteristics are, in particular in terms of loss, sort of how the signal, or the, how the power of the signal decreases with distance, and also effects that you don't typically see in wired systems that are due to mobility, which means that once you're sort of on the move, the characteristics of the channel are varying as you move. Okay, and we'll see what problems this causes. And this will sort of lead us into the second topic of the day, which is spread spectrum modulation. Which is proposed as a technique for dealing with some of the characteristics that sort of specifically are seen on radio channels. In terms of references, again, the primary reference for these notes is Chapter 5 of Stallings. So by the end of today, we'll have sort of covered Chapters 5, 6, and 7 in some detail. Okay. So we want to look at the radio channel and sort of transmission over this channel. Excuse me. And the first thing that we're going to mention is antennas. And, it's not particularly my favorite topic, but signals are transmitted and received for radio systems via antennas. And so we'll have a quick look at sort of the basic properties of antennas and the main thing that we'll take away from this is that they can there can be possibly a gain factor if they're directed in specific directions. Okay. So to start off with, we're going to think of our antenna as being out in space somewhere with nothing impeding its transmission. And the canonical antenna is what's called an isotropic antenna, and this antenna will radiate equally in all directions. So signal goes out equally in any direction. Now, turns out that this isn't exactly easy to build, but we can, it's used for comparison purposes. And typically what we do is we characterize the transmission power of the antenna at some fixed radius. Here we're looking at radius 1, and this is a function of the radiation density, so again, how much power is there in any little spot. And for our isotropic antenna, we assume this is uniform in all directions, so we can look at U mean, and it's then the power is U mean times the surface area of our sphere at radius 1. Okay. So again, this is just sort of, this is a theoretical model of sort of how things might work. Now, typically, antennas, as they're actually built, will concentrate power in a specific direction. And so instead of the power being uniform over all directions, it's sort of more or less in one direction. And so the directionality is an indication of how the power increases in the specific sort of maximum direction. And so, sort of again, typically, if you have an actual antenna, then a good bit of the power can be sort of aimed in a specific direction, but some of the power will be dispersed in sort of non-desirable directions, so you don't get perfect directionality. Now, if you're thinking of cellular systems, there are obviously two ends of your system. There's the base station, which is connected to the network and sort of is the access point for a cellular phone into the network. And then there's the cell phone itself, and obviously both sides need to have antennas. Typically, the cell phone antenna has to be an omnidirectional antenna, so you sort of have to broadcast in all directions, because as a user, you don't know where the base station is. You're not going to be sort of pointing your phone at the base station. At the base station, sort of the access point, then a number of different options are used. And we'll see this coming into play as we talk about the design of cellular systems. The easiest thing to think about is, again, just having an omnidirectional antenna, so it broadcasts in 360 degrees. So, if you're anywhere near the base station, you'll receive the signal. And typically, for performance reasons, we'll actually sectorize the antennas. Will aim it not as broadly, not in 360 degrees, but in some narrower focus. And the reason for this is to prevent interference between one base station and another. Okay. And then you might have point-to-point connections, even sort of back to the backhaul network. So, what types of antennas are out there? One common type is the dipole antenna. And again, this is, I put this up as an example of something that's actually built. And dipole antennas can be used to either transmit, again, in a plane, let's actually move on to the picture. Or you can use dipole antennas to get some approximation of an omnidirectional antenna. What they won't do is radiate sort of in the direction. The dipole antenna, it's a length, a wire, and it won't radiate in the direction of the wire, but you can get something approximating a sphere using dipole antennas. So it's a way of approximating our isotropic antenna, or, you know, more commonly, you might just worry about the 360-degree plane. A more directional type of antenna is a parabolic antenna. And the parabola, the shape of these antennas is a parabola, and this has the function of concentrating the outgoing signal in a single direction. Okay, so the focus of the antenna is sort of where the curve, the perpendicular line, where all those lines would intersect. And so if you're radiating out from the focus, then you'll get the reflections will all go in the same direction. If you're coming in a parallel direction, then all the signal will be concentrated back to this focus. Okay. And again, the end result is, again, you get a directional antenna. Okay. So, again, for most of this module, we're not really going to be concerned with exactly how the antenna gets a signal from point A to point B. What we will note, again, is that if you have a directional antenna, then there is a gain, and that gain is a comparison of the power output if the antenna was omnidirectional, to the power output in a specific direction. Okay. And typically, this gain factor is captured by an effective area term. And so we get that the gain is 4 pi times the effective area over lambda squared, or you can substitute lambda equals C over F into that as well. So you can either do it in terms of the wavelength or in terms of the corresponding frequency. Now, this looks like you are adding a wavelength term to the gain as well. And the answer to that is yes and no. It depends on the sort of antenna. In certain types of antennas, the effective area is a fixed constant. In other types of antennas, the effective area actually has a lambda squared term in it, so that will cancel out and giving you a fixed gain. Okay. Again, from now on, we're essentially just going to assume that we're given a gain factor if it's of interest to us. Okay. So, again, that's a very, very, very quick overview of antennas. And for our purposes, we will be interested in sort of their broad characteristics. So we might say we have an omnidirectional antenna or a sectorized antenna. And in some cases, we will sort of be required to factor gain into our calculations of the antenna. Now, obviously what we want to do with this antenna, again, is to send a signal from point A to point B, and we've noted that we transmit at a certain power level. What we're going to be interested in is, again, at what power level is our signal received? Now, we need to note that signals can travel along one of three routes as they're transmitted. Ground waves follow the contour of the Earth, and they're at sort of low frequencies, and they can travel for long distances. Sky waves bounce off between the Earth's surface and the ionosphere, so they sort of bounce up and down, and again, they have relatively large ranges. The types of signals that we're considering are what are called line-of-sight transmissions, and they're at higher frequencies, and typically, again, it's called line-of-sight because you need a clear path between the sender and the receiver. Now, it's possible that signals can bounce off of objects and sort of get you where you need to go, even if you don't have that clear path, but we'll assume we have a clear path. Now, what we're going to consider now is what happens to that signal as it travels along this path, and specifically two factors. We're going to look at the power of the signal as it arrives at the receiver. So it's not going to be arriving at the same power that it was transmitted at. And that loss of power, again, we'll characterize as loss. And so a number of factors will contribute to that loss. Noise along the channel, absorption, and one that's, again, sort of specific to radio signals, the multipath, where, again, because of signals bouncing off of objects, you might get actually multiple versions of the same signal arriving at the final destination. And again, the signals can either combine or detract from each other. And finally, mobility is going to add an additional factor of making all of these factors change with time. So as you're on the move, the characteristics of your system are going to change as you move. Okay. And what we'll see, just at a very high level, is that all of this contributes, well, one, to a very complicated model for your channel, but at a very high level, we can say something roughly about the power at the receiving end versus the transmitting end. And also, we can look at the characteristics of the channel. And so far, what we've said is that at all frequencies, things like noise and all the effects are more or less uniform. But in reality, because of these factors, certain frequencies within our channel are going to be have more impacted by these factors than other frequencies. So again, if you think about a frequency modulation scheme, certain components are going to sort of be more impacted than others. Okay. And so what we'll see is that two things. One, if you want to characterize this, the models can be quite complex and frequently based on empirical data. And again, two, the mobility factors and how they sort of impact on the frequency characteristics of the channel are going to motivate our looking at different modulation techniques. And we'll look at spread spectrum specifically after we do this summary of our radio channel. Okay, so this is actually, these effects are true of any sort of channels, doesn't have to be a radio channel. First, signals decrease in power with distance. Okay. And so you need to transmit at a high enough signal strength that by the time your signal has decreased in power, it's still strong enough to overcome the noise. So, you know, this is your signal to noise ratio. What's the power of the signal relative to the power of the noise at the receiver. Okay. And so for any signal, this means that you can't sort of send it and expect it to travel an indefinite distance. Again, it's more difficult for radio signals to characterize this attenuation, to characterize exactly how it's dropping off. Another factor is that attenuation is a function of frequency as well as just distance. So if you're transmitting at multiple frequencies, the drop-off in power is going to be greater or less at certain frequencies, and so your signal may be distorted because of that. Now, for radio systems, the first step in characterizing loss is to look at what's called free space loss. And again, here we're considering our antennas out in space somewhere with no additional interference factors. That they can transmit and the signal is not interfered with. Even in this case, the signal still attenuates. And the relationship between the transmitted power and the received power is given by this equation, 4 pi d squared over gr gt lambda squared. And so the factors that are affecting it are the gain of the antenna, and this is can be split up into the gain of the transmitting antenna and the gain of the received antenna. The wavelength at which you're transmitting, and finally, sort of the most significant factor for us, the distance between sender and receiver. So D is the distance between the antennas. And so we can chop and change and put this in terms of effective areas instead if we want. But the basic idea is that the ratio of transmitted power to received power is a function of our distance squared. Okay. And so typically what we actually are interested in is the other way around. We're interested in, given the given a transmitted power, what's the received power? And again, just manipulating that equation, you get the free space equation. And another way we would characterize the difference is in terms of loss. So free space loss is the ratio of the received power to the transmitted power. Okay. And so, again, or finally, we can characterize that in this fashion. And you might also add a term of atmospheric loss. And it works out, again, nicely in decibel terms because, again, each of these factors is just an additional term. Now, one thing that we will frequently do is characterize power relative to power at some standardized point. So essentially what we've done is we're replacing our transmitted power with our power at some standardized point. And again, this just you just need the correction factor. To do that, you just need a correction factor relative to that distance. Okay. And so a condition for choosing that distance is that it has to, the reference distance has to be large enough relative to the distance of the far antenna. And in particular, it should fulfill the Fraunhofer condition. Again, we won't worry too much about that. We'll just say that we can do it. And you know, typically, the sort of specific values are chosen depending on whether you're indoors or out of doors. Okay. And again, what we see from this is our received power and is proportional to our distance squared term. Okay. So, just recapping, we stated this before. This received power gives us our signal strength, and what we need, again, is that the signal strength is large enough relative to noise, and we reviewed what factors we could have for noise last time, so I don't think we need to do it again. Just that we have white noise, thermal noise, which is so uniform across your bandwidth. You can have intermodulation noise from different signals interfering with each other, crosstalk, impulse noise, which again is this intermodulation and crosstalk would be fairly predictable. Impulse noise is sort of fairly random. And again, that will give us our signal-to-noise ratio or our bit energy-to-noise ratio to look at. And particularly, again, when we go into the design of cellular systems, we'll be sort of aiming for specific signal-to-noise ratios. So, at the moment, what we have is that our signal is experiencing free space loss, so it's attenuating as the distance squared. And unfortunately, that's not the end of the story. If it was, then sort of everything would be quite predictable and we'd just deal with it. For radio signals, a number of additional factors come into play which make this, the story of what happens to these signals, much more complicated. Okay. Now the first factor that we will look at is what's called multipath. And the idea here is that we are now not out in space with nothing in any direction, so when we send the signal, it just travels in a straight line to reach our receiver. But we're sort of driving along in the middle of a city or in a mountain somewhere, and our signal, well, there is a direct line from sender to receiver. That's what we would like. But our signal is, again, traveling omnidirectionally, and so it's bouncing off objects that it encounters, and depending on which way it bounces, some of those reflected signals are also arriving at the receiver. And so, these reflected signals can either enforce our initial signal or diminish our initial signal, which it does depends on the phase of all of the signals relative to each other. In general, we're going to be pessimistic and think that the signal is being reduced. And so what we're going to do is a simple exercise where we look at two paths and see how two things might work out for two paths. At the back of your mind, what you might think about is that, okay, we have this object here, our car, and we've drawn out these reflective points. Now, And so we'll calculate sort of, again, how these reflections impact on the signal strength. In actuality, we're not just sitting there, but we're actually moving. And so how this affects the received signal is also changing as we move. So we'll consider that as a separate effect. For the moment, we'll consider that we have our sender, they're at some fixed point, and we have our receiver, and we're going to assume for the moment that we have two paths over which our signal is traveling. So that's a lot of assumptions. We're assuming that we're not moving, and we're assuming that there's only one reflected signal. Okay. But if we look at this, we'll get an idea of what the problem is with this sort of system. Okay. So what we would like to do now is to calculate the power of the received signal. And again, we're going to do that by looking at some fixed point, the power at some fixed point, V0. Now, again, depending on where you are, the default value V0 changes, but it doesn't matter for our calculations. So what we've said so far is that if we're considering a single signal, then the power drops as D squared. Now, if we're considering multiple signals, then we have to consider the phase of the signals. So in particular, if you have a signal, if a second signal is in phase with it, then the signals will combine. If the signal is out of phase, then the signals are going to detract from each other. Okay. So when we make our power calculations, we can't just consider sort of the amplitude of the signal, but we have to consider the phase of it as well. And so the first thing we will do is try to characterize our signal. And again, we'll go to the imaginary plane to do that, sort of a phasor representation. And so the signal is a function of frequency, and that varies with time, and a phase component as well. Okay. Now, we can pull out the frequency component, but what we need to retain is our phase component and compare how the two phases combine with each other. And so, in particular here, the power received along the path is a function of the distance of the two paths and our phase component. Okay, so again, as you travel along that path here, going up and down. And so what we need to do is to calculate our distances and our phases. Okay. And calculating the distances, the length of the paths, well, that's just sort of a geometric exercise, a geometric argument. And so what you see for B1, our direct path, is that we will have a right triangle here, one side's distance D, the other side is H1 minus H2, and just use Pythagoras to calculate the third side of the right triangle. Now, for the second path, well, we can consider continuing it on this way, although the way I've drawn it here is actually not good, but if you think of considering this path on this way, you would get that same length. Here, the height for the one side is H1 plus H2, and then the other side is D. So you get, the distance is H1 plus H2 squared plus D squared and the square root of that. Okay, so just use Pythagoras again. Okay, and so the other thing we need to consider is the phase difference. Using these, if we consider that our distance D is a lot bigger than H1 and H2, then we can approximate both of these distances just by D. Okay. And so instead of considering D1, D2, we just put D in. Once we've done that, what we'll have is 1 over E. We can pull out the D, so we have 1 over EJ phi1 minus 1 over EJ phi2. And so that's a function of the difference between the two phases. Okay, so if you multiply out by one of these phases, the absolute value of it, the amplitude of EJ phi is 1, so that goes away. And you've got EJ phi 1 over EJ phi 2. And so what you're looking at is the difference between those two phases. Okay, and so that difference is a function of the difference in the length of a path traveled, okay? So we're back to needing to know exactly what the length of these two paths is. And to determine that, what we do is we do a Taylor expansion on D1 and D2, and then just take the difference between the two, and we get this term 2H1H2 over D. Okay. So we now have our term delta phi, and we can then substitute in, we have to the e to the j delta phi term. In particular, what we need to do is, again, an approximation of e to the j delta phi is 1 minus j delta phi, and we can plug in then our delta phi term. Okay. And so, plugging that all back in, what you'll end up with is our power loss is now a function of delta phi squared, and if we plug that in, what that gives us is another d squared term. Okay, so what we get in the end is that our loss, our received power relative to our transmitted power, is not a factor of d squared, but of d to the fourth. Okay. And this is sort of a worst case scenario, but it's possible that you could have that sort of loss. Okay. So, what we see from this is that we can, just that additional factors besides free space loss can work to make the power decrease at a much greater rate than before. Okay. And so this is, again, a very simple example. We looked at two paths and what could happen. In reality, signals could be bouncing off a number of objects, and this could become even more complex. Okay. Now, multipath causes additional problems within the system besides just sort of increased attenuation. And so one that we will mention is time dispersion. And so again, we have the idea that we are transmitting now sequences of bits, and our signal arrives directly along one path and potentially is reflected off of some other object and takes some indirect path. Now, the time it takes for the signal to arrive is also a function of the distance it travels. And so if a signal is traveling a significant distance, then the transmission is going to be delayed, and potentially the signals from two different bits will be received at the same time. And so this is not just a matter of sort of receiving the correct signal, but sort of with an attenuated power, but now we're receiving the correct signal plus an incorrect signal or another noise or interference factor. Okay. And again, what you can hope is that this one's more attenuated, but it does add noise to the system. Okay. So, in general, what this means is that we have a very complex model of our channel between sender and receiver, and again, there's going to be noise factors introduced, but the thing that we're going to take away primarily from this is the attenuation factor. And again, we saw with free space loss, our attenuation was with distance squared. And it's very complicated now to characterize the exact attenuation for a situation like this. But typically what one might do is just say that our power is attenuating at some factor of distance between 2 and 5.5 is usually considered to be the maximum. Okay. And so as a sort of quick and dirty rule of thumb, frequently we'll refer to this attenuation factor gamma and just say, well, it's always dropping off at this one fixed rate. Okay. So, as I said earlier, what we've talked about so far refers to just two fixed points and what can happen in trying to just get a signal there from two fixed points. In reality, with cellular systems, our points aren't fixed. Well, the base station is fixed, but the mobile station is exactly that. It's mobile. And so, in addition to sort of the complications from, you know, sort of trying to decide a path from point A to point B for fixed points, now they're moving, and so all of the obstacles that cause all of these effects are changing position relative to our signal. And so we get signals are blocked, they're reflected, they diffract around objects and scatter, but exactly what is happening changes as we move. Okay. And so typically we characterize these changes either in terms of time or sometimes in terms of frequency. In terms of time, we have two effects, of fast fading and slow fading. And so fast fading refers to a rapid variation in signal strength at sort of short distances. So again, this is as the phase is changing. And slow fading refers to those effects as essentially the terrain changes. So as you're driving through a tunnel, is different from when you get out of the tunnel, etc. Okay. And in terms of frequency, we'll just observe that some fading effects will sort of uniformly impact the component, all of the frequency components of a signal, and in some cases, certain frequency components are more impacted than others. Okay, so here we have our slow fading is just, again, as you sort of terrain changes dramatically. Okay, now it's entirely possible, we talk about line of sight, but there may actually be no direct line of sight between transmitter and receiver, and in that case, all of the signal is going to be dependent on being reflected off of objects. Okay. And again, we've seen how that sort of is impacted by distances specifically. Okay, so again, what we get is you would typically expect, a log scale, a steady decrease, and your free space loss is steady. But you have these additional factors that are increasing or decreasing the signal as we go along. Okay, and again, some of these occur sort of at a reasonably slow pace, and some of them occur, rarely fading occurs quite rapidly. Okay. And basically, when you're going to when you calculate the power at which you wish to transmit your signal, you have to try and account for these additional factors as well. Okay. And so, again, if we have a specific receiver sensitivity, we need to send at a high enough power that our slow and our fast fading effects are accounted for. Okay. So we'll return to that in a minute. But right now we are going to just look at sort of again more of the average effects, sort of calculating the average drop off in signal strength. And we saw, again, we could calculate it for two different paths. There's a whole body of research in characterizing sort of specific shapes and rooms or scenarios using loads of paths. Another option has been empirical models, and so what these have observed is that, well, it's difficult to deal with this problem analytically, and maybe you can't depending on what your setup is. So instead what we'll do is we'll just observe various systems, we'll go around and we'll measure power throughout a system, and we'll come up with a mathematical model based on these observations. And so one of the first models was the Lee model, and it was quite simple, based on data from Los Angeles. A more commonly used model is the Akamura model, and again, this was based on data from Tokyo, and then the Hata model was an extension of the Akamura model. It simplified some of the details of the graph. Okay, so the thing to these models are frequently used, but one thing to note is, again, they are based on specific sets of data. And so if you try to apply them to a different scenario, you have to be careful that, you know, it actually is legitimate. For instance, if you take the Akamura model, Tokyo is a very flat city. So might be reasonable to model Washington, D.C. or something in the same way, or Dublin, for that matter, in the same way. It's, you know, nice flat cities. It would probably not be reasonable to apply the model to New York City, which is all skyscrapers. So you have to consider the relevance of the model to something other than the original data. Okay. And so the Lee model is relatively simple. And again, the goal is to model your power at a distance and a number of terms were proposed for doing this. And so you have a distance factor and a frequency factor and then an adjustment factor and then our gamma and n values are going to, and our p0 values are going to be selected based on the data that was collected. So you do sort of a curve fitting to the data as it was collected. Okay, and our correction factor has to do with the characteristics of the antennas. Okay, and so n was the adjustment factor for frequency. And again, that depends on the topography, sort of what sort of a system you're actually dealing with. And so they suggest one factor for suburban and rural areas and a second factor for urban areas. And so based on, again, these factors, which are the ones that are considered important, and, you know, again, the same factors, the frequency, antenna heights, etc., that we were looking at when we were doing our calculation, they do a curve fitting and factor in all those factors. The Akamura model does similar. It's slightly more complex and sort of extensive. But again, it's based on measurements for Tokyo and sort of cellular systems that might be used and sort of those sorts of characteristics. And so here our loss is a measure of free space loss, and then a number of correction factors. And so, whereas before, with the Lee model, those correction factors were given as mathematical equations, for the Akamura model, you end up with these graphs, which are functions of frequency and distance, and again, are fairly complex. Okay. And so we try to, here you're accounting for frequency and distance. Here you're trying to correct for what sort of an area you're in, sort of the terrain of the area. And then the antenna heights are factored in as an equation. Okay, and so even within those equations, there's more factors to consider, which again are given graphically. So this is quite a detailed model, and it's, again, if you're for the system that was studied, it's quite accurate. Again, it's a bit difficult to use just because of all the different factors and the fact that they're graphical. So I think you guys can read through the example, so you can plug in various values and calculate free space loss. Then read the correction factors off of the charts, and to calculate a mean path loss. Okay, so again, quite detailed, quite accurate, sort of for that specific situation. The Hata model is an extension then of the Akamura model, and the idea here is to simplify, to get rid of the graphs and try and characterize the graphs as mathematical formulae. And so instead of having graphs, you've got again more mathematical formula representing correction factors. Okay. And exactly what correction factor you use, again, is dependent on the type of system that you're trying to apply this to. Okay, and so you have urban areas, suburban areas, and open areas. Okay. And so these models are, they're interesting for our purposes. I will give you a few tutorial programs where you just grind through all these aspects. On an exam, I wouldn't necessarily expect you to be able to reproduce the formulas or anything, but they're interesting because they're an attempt to, again, give an accurate representation of loss in these sorts of systems, again, rather than just sort of picking a factor and using that. Okay. Okay. So, to wrap up this segment of the lecture, we are going to return to the multipath phenomenon and again look at what the impact of this sort of phenomenon is on our system. And specifically what we're going to note is that, again, the loss is now no longer uniform over our frequency domain. Okay. And so exactly how the signal impacts on the system is going to be dependent on the signal bandwidth. Okay, so we're going to have these losses at specific frequencies, and you have to ask how that frequency fits in relative to the overall bandwidth of the system. Okay. And so just to sort of make things a little more concrete, we sort of have a specific delay between the two paths, so sort of a specific distance difference. And what this means is that you're going to have a maximum attenuation at 1 over tau, or every 100 kilohertz. Okay. And so what we'll do is we'll look at how this impacts on sort of different bit rate transmissions, where, again, bit rate is going to correspond to bandwidth. Okay. So our first system is a narrowband system. And so here the channel characteristics are going to be pretty uniform over the whole bandwidth. So we get attenuation but not distortion. And we can experience flat fading, so if the delay n is greater than the bit period. For wider band signals, what we will see is that we have selective fading, so certain frequencies are going to be eliminated, and the system will experience attenuation but not distortion, and we can have longer delays, which will cause inter-symbol interference, and that needs to be compensated for. And finally, if we have a wideband system, then we have significant delays, so we have significant inter-symbol interference, and you end up with a lot of notches through the signal. Okay. Now, what we'll see is that there's a number of ways to sort of try and counteract these effects. We can try for diversity of reception, and so there's a number of ways to do this. We can try to sort of have multiple antennas to receive the signal, or we can try and replicate the signal over a number of different channels so that, you know, you can try and combine what you get in from each channel into a good signal. Okay, so for space diversity, we have more than one antenna, and you try and space them so that the fading that occurs in the two channels is not going to be correlated. So if you experience fading on one channel, hopefully you won't experience fading on the second channel. And then you try and pick the correct channel. So this can give you improved performance, but at the cost of additional hardware. And we'll look a bit more into this later on when we discuss actual cellular systems. Okay, and so if you have multiple signals, again, there's different ways of trying to extract the correct signal. You might just take the strongest one, or you might try and take information from both. Okay. And so again, what you hope is that you have these effects where any single signal is being dropping out or being lost, but if you combine the signals together, depending on how you combine them, you can again recover more of your signals. Okay, so again, other options, you can transmit the signal at two different frequencies. Again, this requires additional bandwidth and hardware to do. Time diversity, you can send the signal at different times. And this gets into the area of channel coding, because what you're really doing is then you're sending a redundant signal. And so, you know, again, what's the best way to do that? Okay. You can have path diversity, so if the equipment can sort of distinguish the path along which the signal arrived, then you can sort of try and use that to recover the signal. Or polarization diversity, where you try and receive, again, at different phase offsets. Okay, and so the transmitter, there's correspondingly also transmitter diversity. You can transmit, so again, multiple copies of the same signal. Okay, so the two main points to take away from this segment of the lecture are, first of all, that power does decrease as some factor of the distance. And again, when we next week, when we start looking at the design of cellular systems, we're just going to pick a factor and assume it's fixed. And secondly, that there are effects within the channel that are not uniform, and so certain frequency components can be more impacted than others. And what we're going to look at after the break is spread spectrum modulation. And so the idea is, if you have a narrow band frequency, then, well, certain components could be, well, certain frequencies might be wiped out pretty much altogether. And so with spread spectrum, you try and spread your transmission over a greater frequency. And, of course, the trick to doing that is going to be, well, again, if bandwidth is at a premium, how do you then share this broader bandwidth? And so we'll take up with that after about a 15-minute break. Please don't let me lose this.